Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Shel Copperell, who is a professor emeritus here at Grand Valley State University, and we're talking about the biblical book Exodus. Shel has taught at Grand Valley for 47 years. He's taught both science and religion. He is also on the board of directors of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. So let's pick up our conversation today. Shel, welcome back.
Thank you, Fred. It's good to be back.
Last week, I remember I had to hurry you a little bit because we were running out of time, but we were talking about the Levites and whether or not they historically existed, because you say that there is a theory in Judaism that the patriarchs are allegorical, shall we say?
I think that that's a good term. I'd like to say that we believe that there are a number of stories in the Bible. Now, I should point out that, as I said before, there is virtually no consensus among the, quote, Jewish community about almost anything, and when it comes to the Holy Writ, that perhaps is as touchy a subject as any. But certainly from my standpoint, I think, and I don't feel that the Bible is any less important or any less sacred or special to me, even if some of the narratives are not of historical 100% accuracy. And so to me, at least, the story of the patriarchs are allegorical. These are people who were clearly not perfect. I mean, we see that Abraham, all three of our patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, had certain personality traits and family relationships that I think today we would call dysfunctional.
To say the least.
To say the least. And I think that the purpose of these patriarchs is the origin of certain other personality traits. This was a special family chosen by God to be the progenitors of his people. And these people are shown with all the flaws of normal humans, but they also did try to follow, for the most part and to the best of their ability, God's directives. And that includes Jacob, who may very well have had 12 sons, and who knows how many daughters. It's interesting that the Bible mentions and discusses all 12 sons, gives the etymologies of each of their names. We talked about Levi, but you could do the same with the other 11. But the only daughter mentioned is Dinah. And even though we know from Hebrew that that refers to something to do with justice and judgment, there's nothing about her name, and there is a story about her existence, but that leads to one of the mindless slaughters in the Bible. And interestingly, one of the people involved in the slaughter, Dinah had gone out from her protective community and fell under the spell of Shechem, who was the leader of one of the towns in the area, one of the idolaters. He fell mad. He was madly attracted to her, and he took her. Nowhere in the Torah does it say he raped her, but the story, and this is chapter 34 in Genesis, often called the rape of Dinah. Now, Dinah was the daughter of both Jacob and Leah, the first wife, and Levi and Simeon, the second and third sons, were full brothers to Dinah. And so Levi and Simeon concocted a plan to gain revenge, and to make a long story as short as possible, they convinced Shechem and his father, who was the local chieftain, that the Israelites would be happy to have relations with their daughters and have good interaction with the community if the men were circumcised, because the Canaanites were not circumcised, and yet the Jews were. They agreed. They were circumcised. And on the third day after circumcision, when the pain was the greatest, according to the biblical story, Simeon and Levi and their henchmen rushed the town, slaughtered all the men, and laid it to waste. And they rescued the daughter. Nowhere does it say the daughter wanted to be rescued, but they did anyway. And that, I think, is important because the Levites throughout the Torah are described as being the zealous ones for God, which is another reason why they may have been chosen as the priests, if we follow the story of the Exodus as presented in the Bible, because it was Levi who zealously defended his sister. It were the Levites who, after the golden calf incident, took Moses aside. Moses was a descendant of the tribe of Levi, and they rather bloodily slaughtered a number of the Israelites who were active in the golden calf making and worshiping. It was Phinehas, who I mentioned last week, who zealously slew the offending man and woman of when the Midianite women tried to seduce the men into worshiping the Baal. And there were some other examples as well where the Levites took an active role in showing extreme zealotry for God.
So the people today who are supposedly the descendants of Levi, they have names such as Levi itself, mm-hmm. or Levi, and also Cohen, Cowan, Cohen, all of those. Those are all descendants of Levi, correct?
Yes, the Kohanim were the priests. The Levites as a whole were the priestly tribe, but most of the Levites who were not Kohanim, in other words, descended from the proper part of the Levite tribe, the Kohanim were the Aaron, Moses' brother, was the progenitor of the Kohanim. And it's interesting because many of these people with the name Cohen or related names, they've found genetically that they do share certain similarities on the Y chromosome, the one that's passed down from father to son, because it's the male that bears the lineage, the tribal lineage. It's an interesting because traditional Judaism says that a Jew is defined as someone who has a Jewish mother.
Right.
And yet the lineage comes through the father's side. Why is it the Jewish mother? Because we know for sure that that's her child, and because the mother plays such an important role in nurturing and informal education. If one of the parents is going to put the child on the track of obeying laws and commandments, even though the father has to formally educate the child, particularly the son, it's the mother who has the greatest influence.
So when you say that you aren't 100% certain that the person, the patriarch Levi, existed, you would agree that people who do have those names, such as Cohen and Cowan, etc., that their ancestors were priests?
The Kohanim, the statistically significant connection, the Levites is a different story, because similar studies were done with people with the name Levi, Levin, etc. They didn't find the same degree of consistency as they did with the Kohanim.
Oh, I see.
So, but then, of course, the Levites were the assistants. They weren't the priests themselves. And there was a very sharp distinction in biblical times. Today, we still see that distinction in the Orthodox and conservative congregations, that is, the most traditional congregations, in that when the Torah is read, the Bible is read on the Sabbath and the holidays, the first person to be called up for the honor of reading for the Torah is a Kohen, the second person is a Levi, and then the third and the succeeding ones are anyone, the Israelites. That's the three groups of Jews, the Kohanim, the Levites, and the Yisrael, the Israelites. And as a matter of full disclosure, I should point out that my wife, her maiden name is Lovey. So I've heard a lot about that from from family history.
If, in fact, the prophecy is correct, that the temple will be rebuilt and that Judaism will resume its sacrificial tradition, would it be incumbent upon the Kohens, the Cowens, etc., to return to Israel and become the priests?
Among those who feel that this is a foreordained idea, that this will happen, and in the Orthodox prayer service, they do talk about speedily and in our days, may the temple be reestablished in Jerusalem, that would be the case, that there would be Kohanim who could be identified, who would resume the job of high priest. Just as when the second temple was built, after admittedly only a 70-year exile, that the Kohanim, for the most part, could trace their lineage back to the pre-exilic priestly family. I would guess, and I don't have other than a sense from what I've learned and studied and talked to people, that by far the majority of Jews, including many of the Orthodox, don't either realistically see that happening or, quite frankly, don't want it to happen. And in today's day and age of conflict in the Holy Land, it's just not realistic.
I completely understand that.
Yeah.
I could also imagine some poor guy named Cowan who sells insurance all of a sudden grabbed by an Orthodox rabbi saying, hey, I got something better for you.
It's your calling.
Yeah. That's right.
But it is interesting that it is part of the liturgy. And even now, after the 70 years after the foundation of the State of Israel, we still end our Passover Seder, the evening meal, with L'shana haba'a Berushalayim, next year in Jerusalem.
Right. Let's get back to the book in just a moment, as soon as I remind people that if you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Professor Shel Kopperl, as we discuss Exodus. Getting back to Richard Friedman's book entitled The Exodus, how does slavery embolden his theory of this miniature Exodus?
That's an interesting question because, of course, slavery was the whole idea behind the need for the Exodus, that God had heard the cry of his oppressed people and selected Moses at the burning bush in Exodus chapter 3 to be the one who, despite Moses's trying to rid himself of the task, God did select Moses to lead the people into freedom. So, if indeed Friedman's hypothesis is correct, or close to being correct, was there really a slave situation, or were these people, these Levites, now more or less discredited in the eyes of the Egyptians because they were holding a theology that had been supplanted by, once again, the more traditional Egyptian theology? So why would, and of course this is a good question anyway, why would God's chosen people be slaves other than to show that God could take the smallest, the weakest, and turn them into a society that would follow God's laws and be, as they say in the Hebrew, the English translation is treasured people, Am Segula, his treasured people. And so the slavery idea came into being because it would be, the idea that these were people who would be liberated from the old way of looking at things and would be completely free of their old mannerisms and be receptive to receiving a new set of laws and guidance from the Israelites. Incidentally, even in the Bible, it makes it very clear one of the things we see frequently in movies, and I think that Cecil Bill DeMille's Ten Commandments may have been the start of this, that the Egyptians made the Jews build the pyramids. Now, the Bible says very clearly that they built storage cities. And if you remember the story in Genesis about Joseph, they had to have these storage cities to store the surplus of grain during the years of good, years of plenty. And it is interesting that even so many years later, when the Hebrews were made the slaves, their task was to make these storage cities, Pitom and Ramses. And incidentally, the city of Ramses, the name very close to the king, the pharaoh Ramses II, who is the king that many of the people who believe that the massive exodus really occurred, was the king, either the king that didn't know Joseph and made the Israelites slaves, or the pharaoh under whom the Israelites left Egypt. And that's true whether it's the small group, the Levites, according to Friedman, or the 600,000 plus, according to the biblical story.
The author, Friedman, claims that the assumption that the Exodus did not happen, at least didn't happen en masse, due to lack of archaeological evidence, is a specious one. That's what he says. But don't historians make that claim in all investigations? I mean, what's different about this case?
The thing that's different in this case is that the realization, if indeed 2.5 million people left, there would be examples, that there would have to be almost some sort of evidence that this huge, especially in a climate like Egypt and the Sinai Desert, where things just don't change that much over long periods of time, and there's absolutely no evidence for this. I was talking to a group of people not too long ago, and one person was saying that he had read a specious article that in one of the smaller bodies of water near the Sinai Desert, archaeologists had discovered chariots, like the Egyptian war chariots, at the bottom of that sea. And of course, according to our story, the Israelites had to cross the Sea of Reeds, not the Red Sea, by the way. Yam Suf in Hebrew is the Sea of Reeds, a much smaller body of water. And that, of course, is where the greatest miracle of all occurred, that the Pharaoh and his army, after Pharaoh had one of his many changes of heart, actively pursued the fleeing Israelites and got to them at the bank of the sea. The only way for the Israelites to escape was to cross the sea, and God made it happen. And even the text of the Bible says that a strong east wind blew and parted the sea. But after Moses raised his staff and prayed for that to happen, so many of us picture Charlton Heston holding the staff and in the movie, but the idea here is that I've lost my train of thought.
The idea of the parting of the Red Sea or the Reed Sea,
yeah,
being a miracle or not,
mm-hmm.
and finding those chariots.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So this story was that there were the chariots at the bottom of the sea, therefore that must have happened. We don't have any kind of archaeological evidence like that at all. And in fact, it isn't until you get into the period of the kingdoms, the Israelite monarchy, that we begin to see both written and archaeological evidence showing that a lot of what's described in the books of Kings, Chronicles, is actually based on historical fact. We have written documents that list the names of some of the kings of Judah and Israel. We have the archaeological remains of cities that are mentioned in the Bible, Hazor, Megiddo, some of these other. Megiddo is an interesting city because it's near a mountain, and in Hebrew, mountain is Har, and Har Megiddo, where a great battle is supposed to take place, is Armageddon.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't take that much imagination. These cities really existed, and the archaeological remains are very close to what we see. Unfortunately, for earlier examples, we don't see that. So that even the famous Battle of Jericho, archaeology shows us that Jericho is one of the oldest continuously inhabited places on earth. But it doesn't show at the time the battle was supposed to occur that there was a massive destruction that you would expect, that the walls came a-tumbling down. So even there, the archaeological evidence is mixed. It's only after about two more centuries that we're beginning to see the closer evidence.
You know, it's funny. One gets the impression that a significant criticism by Friedman in his book, The Exodus, is that scholars are too specialized. So you've got theologians, historians, archaeologists, et cetera, and they all seem to have their own biases. It reminds me of several years ago, I had this growth on my neck, and it started to get painful. So I went to my primary care physician. Then I ended up going to my dentist, and he sent me to a root canal specialist. And they were all telling me that the other people, forget about the other people. You know, one would think science is science. Medical science is medical science. And that this growth, that all of them would work in concert with one another. But apparently that's not the case. This is what I learned. Same thing here, right?
Yeah, it's true that academicians, biblical scholars, regardless of their particular leaning in terms of theology, they all have become, and this is the nature of academic training. When you go for your PhD or Doctor of Divinity degree, you learn more and more about less and less. And so you have become a specialist in this little tiny field, and it's almost impossible to find common ground with people who may be in the same broader area than you, but their little field is somewhat removed from yours. And so we have literary historians, we've got archaeologists, and one of the points that Friedman makes, one of the major themes he gets to right at the beginning of his book, that is that all of these people have to work together, understand each other, in order to be able to, if your goal is to explain how these things might have occurred, how they possibly could have occurred.
That sounds like just an incredible task.
It is, believe me. But it's fun. Speaking as a religious scholar in his later years, I find it's fascinating to read through some of the parts of the Holy Scriptures, regardless of which religion, and try to see how the narratives, the literary people, the historians, the theologians, the archaeologists, etc., put these stories together. And if you read a good, honest Bible commentary that includes all of this, how the authors of the commentary try to make the most of this, try to put it all together and synthesize this whole thing.
I would suspect that the people who would have problems with that approach that you just mentioned are the ones that really have the burning need to know exactly what happened and do not want to leave any room for doubt or conjecture.
You're absolutely right. And ironically, that consists of two major groups, the fundamentalists, and there are as many Jewish fundamentalists as there are Christian fundamentalists, and the extreme scientific atheists, the ones who believe this is all fiction and none of it was true whatsoever, leaving the vast majority of us who are rationally trained by our Western education system, yet want to have some, we have faith, some sort of belief in at least the moral rectitude of our holy scriptures, that we want to leave some stuff to mystery. I was trained as a chemist. I understand molecular biology, and the goal of which is to explain all of life in terms of chemistry and physics, but I don't want that to happen. I really would like to leave some mystery, something unexplainable, that means that there's something beyond what we humans are capable of. I'm perfectly satisfied with that. In fact, I'd prefer that, which makes me sometimes, I get some strange looks from people in our science departments, but I don't mind that. I can live with that very nicely, especially now that I'm retired.
Exactly, exactly. Shell, as always, it's a pleasure to have you here on Common Threads. And even though you're moving to Sacramento, I don't think this is going to be your last time on here, because we do have those telephone machines that people talk about so much that means we can get you here anytime. But we've got a year of your presence here anyway before you make the big move.
Yeah, and we haven't really decided for sure. We have, our family is all on the West Coast now, and even though we've loved the nearly 50 years we've been living here in West Michigan, it is important for us to be close to family. But you're right, I look forward to my next appearance by radio.
Yeah. By telephone. Program.
By telephone, yes. Right. And certainly looking forward to working with you again on any issue of mutual interest.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. With me today, Professor Emeritus Sheldon Copperell and member of the Board of Directors of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Please join us again next week here on WGVU.